Hello, everyone. I am very happy to finally welcome you back for a new episode of the Myst History Podcast. My name is Luke Morgante, and in this episode, I was lucky enough to chat with Andrew Barrett, a historian from the Missouri University of Science and Technology with a background in modern East Central European history. Most of our conversation centers on his work on the concept of historical representation in video games, or HRIVG for short. HRIVG tries to address questions of video games as representations of the past, exploring ideas of what it means to represent history and where this may connect to our own perceptions of the past. I hope you enjoy the episode. All right, Andrew, it's such a pleasure and an honor to have you on for this episode. We first met at a conference by chance last year in Vienna, and I have been hoping to talk to you about these topics pretty much since then. As someone who loves video games and loves history, it's something that just gets me very excited, and I was hoping that we could start off by you explaining your initiative of HRIVG and how it first developed.
Yeah, thank you, Luke. Thanks for having me on a different platform here. It's good to talk again. A long way from sunny, hot Vienna here in the frigid January. But yeah, thanks for asking about HRIVG. And I think you're right. Initiative is kind of what this has ended up being in my life. It's something that has been a running project now for, well, 6 years in various ways. And I'd like it to be a larger initiative than it is, but you know, video games aren't going away, so there's plenty of time to work on it. And historical representation in video games is centered on a class that I teach at the Missouri University of Science and Technology, and which I developed through the help of an eFellows grant that our school offers for the creation of courses that are either fully online or blended, so that there's a strong online and digital component, which is the case for this course, where there's a kind of 1 day a week meeting that's dedicated to just pure discussion, and then everything else is done online. And, you know, it made a lot of sense to apply for that grant, not only because it helped me pay for equipment and games and things which are, you know, expensive, but it's also, of course, fun to pay for those things with the grant, but also because it, you know, this is a natural fit for a course like this, where you would really have to have most things digital anyway, since you're talking about a digital medium. So that course first was developed beginning in 2019, and I had the miss/fortune of running it for the first time in the fall of 2020, when life was completely online anyway for me. But I also at the time had a infant, and trying to develop this course for the first time and make all the videos and stuff for it while having a 3-month-old was not a historical serendipity. It was not the best coincidence. But I've done it 2 times since then, and the students are always really into it. So, you know, it centers on this course, but I'd like to think of it as having potential for speaking to the phenomenon of historical games more broadly.
What stands out are the two parts of the name to me. First of all, I grew up someone who really enjoyed video games. Reading through some of your work, I see Civilization referenced, Red Dead Redemption, Assassin's Creed, the big hitters.
Big hitters, and yeah.
Could you kind of break down the historical representation part of the name and then how video games play into historical education or historical representation?
Yeah, for sure. That title is very, very deliberate. And it speaks to why I wanted to come up with the course in the first place. So, I mean, on a certain level, the course emerged from getting to know my students at S&T, which is, you know, it's an engineering school. And I think that it has a higher propensity, if I would bet, of students who, you know, play video games regularly, who are, you know, make that a kind of part of their identity. And in the first year that I taught there, a lot of students asked me about, have you played Hearts of Iron 4? Or, you know, do you know this or that game? And, or this thing that you told me about reminds me of something that, you know, I read on a Hoi 4 Reddit or something. And I'm like, okay, well, clearly there's an interest here in historical video games. I've had a historical interest in historical video games since basically I started playing video games. You know, I grew up with Europa Universalis 1 and 2 and the original Age of Empires and Age of Empires 2 and stuff like this. So there was already sort of common ground that I could see that that was, you know, fertile here for cultivating relationships between me and my students and getting engineers, who principally who I teach, more invested in history as a discipline, as a concept, as a way of thinking. But so in the course of trying to imagine what a history video game based class would be like, I had another goal and an even deeper goal, which is I wanted to use it not as like a, simply a kind of lure, you know, like putting a pie under a box and, you know, having the students come and get trapped in there and suddenly they're in a history class, but using it as a vehicle unwittingly on their part for infiltrating in kind of Trojan horse is the metaphor I often use, for infiltrating in concepts in the philosophy of history and introducing students who otherwise would never get introduced to the idea of historiography, which we can get into later. And so it is a history course first and foremost. It is a high concept history course, but it is done through video games because I think introducing these concepts through video games is easier. And we can talk about why that is. So in designing the course, I wanted to be very, very picky about what I would call it. And I think that, you know, when I first workshop the idea to people, they'd hear history, they hear video games, and they're like, oh, you're going to do history through video games. Or sometimes they'd say, oh, you're going to do the history of video games. That is not what this course is about. I mean, there you kind of get some of those things, but that's not the point. The point is to understand the nature of, or explore the nature of, the representation of the past, historical representation. And so we're using video games to look at, you know, on a kind of mechanical, conceptual, literary level, how history is reconstructed, how it is put into a medium, and how people interact with it in that way. And so it has bigger ambitions than just looking at video games. It's a kind of a media studies class. It's a kind of media literacy, but it's also a philosophy of history class. And so that's what, I mean, that's the core phrase here. And sometimes, you know, not everyone I talk to kind of picks up on that at first, which is understandable, but I try to, you know, make it very clear that no, this is about historical representation, not trying to use video games to, you know, teach the subject matter in the same way that I would in a normal setting. And we can talk about why that distinction is so important, if you like.
Yeah, I think that would be great. And so the way I'm understanding it right now is that it's not so much that you would use Assassin's Creed 2, for example, to teach students about the Italian Renaissance. Instead, you're using that as an example of how that time period is depicted within this source being the video game, how they choose to represent that history.
Yeah, that's much closer to it. You're right. I don't use these games to, like you say, like with Assassin's Creed. No, I mean, there are many things about Assassin's Creed and the Assassin's Creed series which have their virtues for trying to do that in a certain way. But it's, in, you know, I would say this course is not even really about any specific time period, but trying at a very high level of abstraction, getting students to think about, for example, when I do have the students play Assassin's Creed 2, that's one of the three games that I've assigned in the course. And they have to complete a project for that unit. And the way that I structured the course is that it's broken into three units based on historical perspectives. So one of the questions I had in coming up with the course is, you know, how do you divide it? Do you do it by genre? Do you do it by some kind of historical thematic focus? But what I decided to do is by perspective. So this is the micro, the meso, and the macro perspective based on the sort of field of vision and the subjectivity of who or what you play as in the game, what kind of power you have over the world and your place in the world that is represented. So a game like Assassin's Creed is a first-person game in that you are playing as a single individual, although it is shot from a third-person perspective, so from behind the character. But in historical terms, I think of it as a micro game because you only are one historical actor, right? You don't control a group of people. You don't control an entire planet or anything like that. You are one person. Although that person in Assassin's Creed is always basically a superhuman, you know, it's a virtual representation of a superhuman assassin, whatever. When they complete that project on this perspective, I ask them in their, you know, based on their playthrough of Assassin's Creed 2, what does the fact that you are this person, and in particular in Assassin's Creed 2, that's the character Ezio, who has all these, like all the characters do in Assassin's Creed, these fantastic powers of parkour and fantastic violence, and, you know, have this kind of superhuman ability. The fact that you are this one actor in this representation of Florence for the most part, and that you have all these abilities, how does that fact seem to shape or force or distort or, you know, or give advantages to the way that history itself is represented in the game? So that can be, if the students want to, they can talk about, well, you know, this means that certain details are left out, like, you know, we've got the Duomo, but everything else in Florence is kind of generic. All the people are generic because, you know, it doesn't really matter. You don't have to interact with them very much. They're just kind of background there. Or like the buildings are modified in such a way as to have very convenient footholds. And there's always like a hay cart that you can go hide in, and things like this. That the world has been kind of structured around the nature of the player. And then that means that the representation itself is somehow warped or modified to suit the fact that you are this particular person. So it's not even so much about a specific period of time or what is the time that is purported to be represented in the game, but kind of on a mechanical level, a structural level, a meta level, a meta historical level, how video games force the representation of the past in certain ways.
And you've mentioned a couple of times now the philosophy of history and the term historiography. Mm-hmm. What exactly do you mean by those and how do they connect to this?
Yes. No, that's a fantastic question. And there I have to, I don't know, I have to tread lightly because I can't claim to have the most masterful command of the discipline of philosophy of history, which is really a very specialized field within philosophy. That's not something I've been trained in. My access to it is as a practitioner, sort of a practicing historian who came up in a kind of traditional historical way where you take certain courses and you read certain authors. And sometimes you are asked to think about, like, you know, what is it what we're really doing here on a kind of intellectual level? And what are the implications phenomenologically and ethically and, of trying to represent the past. So when I say philosophy of history, I mean kind of at a very fundamental level, what does it mean to try to understand the past, as, like epistemologically, like as a field of understanding, as a field of knowledge? And what are the implications of how we try to represent it on this meta level? But when I talk about historiography, I mean, that's a very capacious word. That comes up a lot the farther you get, of course, in your history coursework. It's a word that most of my students don't have to encounter usually unless they're history majors, and we don't have a ton of those. So, you know, as I explain it to my students, like there are narrower and broader ways of using that term. And like the professional way that it's often used, at least certainly as I've encountered it, is historiography is the history of history writing and of historians. So a kind of history of the discipline and the way that the discipline has changed over the centuries, its intellectual influences, its currents, right? The different trends in understanding what the nature of history is and the different schools of thought, von Ranke and the Annal school and postmodernism and the cultural turn and these kinds of phrases that are usually associated with historiography as a part of the historian's trade. But I also, what I really want to do with the course is to get them thinking about it, because remember, these are engineers and you know, they don't have much use for von Ranke, at least they don't think so, to think about historiography in a broader term, which is like the act of writing history or the act of representing the past in no matter what the medium is, not just a traditional world of academic and professional historians writing books and articles and, you know, going to archives and so forth, but that every medium that tries to represent the past, I argue, is engaging in historiography, right? It's making some kind of claim about this is the way the past was. Some of them are better. Some of them are not so good. Some of them are very superficial. Some of them are more considerate. But in any case, if you try to represent the past, you are, whether you mean to or not, entering into historiography as an intellectual act. And that's the perspective that I bring to this course and what I want the students to try to get, familiar with.
How do you think that in this endeavor of choosing how to represent the past, how do you think that video games compare to other forms of media? I kind of see the relationship with film, television, and maybe some books that are kind of alternate history or historical fiction, where the goal isn't directly to represent history in as pure, as true of a fashion as possible, but it's kind of a balance between, in the case of video games, making a fun style of gameplay,
yeah,
and fitting that within these historical boundaries. How do you think that they compare to other types of media, and how do you think the best way is to go about that?
Yeah, I mean, Luke, it's a fundamental question. It's an essential question. And it's also a question that while I thought about it and tried to grapple with it, I still feel kind of in over my head with it. It's because once you start down that road, it just opens up all these other corridors and that never seem to end. And maybe I'm overthinking it. Of course, I mean, so far, if anyone's, who's been listening to this will think, well, this guy's clearly overthinking it. I guess that's my, I can't help it.
I don't think you are.
So, I do bring this up in the beginning of the course, in an introductory video. And there, I kind of briefly touch upon this kind of running debate that has, I wouldn't say it's been settled exactly, but, it used to be much more of a debate about whether video games are art or not, right? That they can even be dignified with that title. And I think the answer is yes. I think that's an easy answer. But then the question is, how do they relate to other forms of media and art? And my first thought, and this is probably coming out of my training as a Central Europeanist, but also as a musician in my kind of earlier days, is to think about them in Wagnerian terms, kind of as a Gesamtkunstwerk, right? A total work of art, where it necessarily they require, even simpler games, require forms of representation that are visual, that are textual, that are sonic, that are haptic. That is, how they might interact with the sensation, the system of the body. If you got like a feedback controller, or even the way that your two hands interact with the keyboard of the mouse or with a controller or something like that. And there's more than that. So there's all these ways in which to engage in historical video game is to engage on all these different levels in a way that I think is not inherently true for cinema or for textual representation. I mean, of course, there's a lot of debate that can be had about that, which is fine. But, you look at the credits in any modern video game, and a game like Red Dead Redemption 2, it's like genuinely 10, 15 minutes of credits. Hundreds, if not thousands of people have been working on these games across all these axes of, media forms. And it takes an incredible amount of coordination to create a modern game because it envelops so many forms of art. But that doesn't answer your question, which is, what are the distinctions? And one of the things that I've been trying to play with is, I think that there are two big distinctions that I want to make. One is that games are fundamentally, at their core, they're systems of rules that are worked through as processes. And I'm drawing here on the work of Jesper Juul in understanding, kind of the fundamental nature of a game. It doesn't matter what kind of game it is, video or otherwise, right? It's a game because it functions according to the system of rules. And you only proceed through the game as you go through the different steps, as you play through the rules. And that, I think, is a fundamental difference from something like a film or something like a textual representation, which, well, yes, you know, there's a beginning and end to the film. It takes time, right? Same thing with reading. But when you play a historical video game, there isn't a single complete text. There isn't a stable text in the way that there is, like, the book is the book, the film is the film, that if you replayed it every time, it would be exactly the same thing over and over. It wouldn't, none of its components would change. A video game isn't like that, because a video game requires the player to make inputs, to interact with the system. And so every interaction with that system, with that representation of the past that the game purports to have, results in a greater or lesser different outcome, right? So every time that you hit the arrow key or the WASD key and try to get Ezio to run around Florence, even if you ran him around in a circle pointlessly on one playthrough of the game and you didn't do that on another playthrough of the game, that is a different playing through of the system and therefore inherently a different representation of the past. It's not a meaningful difference, but it is a different one in the way that when you watch a film from one viewing to the next, the characters don't do different things. So hopefully that makes sense. That is one way in which they are at a fundamental level different. And that comes back to the player, right? The player is a unique factor in a way that a reader is not, or a viewer is not in other works of art, because the work, the text itself can only proceed if the player is involved, and the way that the player completes the system or works through the system fundamentally affects the way that the text is constructed. So there is no stable text. What that ends up doing, I think, is creating a representation of the past that is inherently, and this is something I've been trying to wrestle with, and so, you know, I don't know if I'm onto something or not, but a representation of the past that is inherently structured around the existence of the player, around the accommodation of the player, in a way that no other representation of the past is. For example, this representation of Florence in Assassin's Creed 2, it is made for the sake of the player, right? The way that the built environment is constructed, the way that the non-player characters interact or don't interact with the character is for the sake of the character, because there is a player who has to play through the game. You wouldn't have that in a traditional representation of the past where it just has a different goal. Hopefully that makes sense. And I think that's not a short answer, but that is, I think, the most basic way I can talk about that right now.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting concept. I think it makes a lot of sense, and kind of a tangent maybe, but it made me think about how I have a friend that's been training to become a pilot for a while now. Mm-hmm. And when you're learning to be a pilot, in some cases, they put you in a flight simulator. Gets pretty close, from what I've heard, to actual simulation of a flight, what a flight would actually be like if you were in the cockpit. Do you think in the future there may be a kind of history simulation that could be used to train historians? Like being able to walk through a depiction of history that is meant to be as historically accurate as possible, not taking as many liberties for gameplay mechanics. It's kind of an abstract question.
No.
That could be a thing in the future.
It's not tangential at all. I think it really gets to the heart of what I'm trying to talk about in this question of the player, which sometimes I try to think of as like the player trap or the problem of the player. But also it gets at what this course is about in a fundamental level. And so it's funny that you bring up the idea of a history simulator, because that is the premise of Assassin's Creed, the entire series, which is based around not you as the player actually being in the past, but you as the player controlling a virtual reality simulation of the past that is generated from DNA. And that, you know, when you play Ezio in Assassin's Creed 2 or Bayek in Assassin's Creed Origins or whatever, you are a person in the modern day who is in like a capsule, like a fancy tanning bed, basically, with, you know, super technology that has reconstructed the past based on the DNA of these superhuman figures that in the Assassin Templar conflict or whatever. So this has clearly been thought about as an idea and is already, you know, kind of at the heart of one of the biggest, if not the biggest, historical video game series out there. So it's a very relevant question. But in some ways, I think it's still not the right question, because what I'm trying to get the students to think about is essentially that even if you had such a simulator, the question would be who is deciding how that past is represented? What are the sources of knowledge that are being used to represent that past? What is being left in? What is being left out? Because short of some kind of cosmic, you know, godlike ability to play back, to literally like replay everything that has ever happened exactly the way that it happened, you are always stuck in the problem of having to represent it. It can never be fully reconstructed. The past is only accessible to us as a set of representations, you know, mediated through the forms of knowledge that we have that come from the past and the narratives and things that we tell ourselves about the past. I don't know what you would have to be able to do or what you would have to be able to invent or what kind of technological breakthrough there would have to be in order to ever escape the fundamental requirement of representation and all the authorial choices that come with that. Assassin's Creed tries to come up with one, which is through DNA, right? To root this in an objective truth that cannot be manipulated. I mean, that leads to all the kinds of questions about, I mean, on an ethical level, about what does it mean to have the past somehow as a congenital reality that is passed through, hereditary material, etc. So in other words, I don't think such a simulator can exist, or rather, how would it train historians? The historians would still be basically doing what they're already doing now, which is deciding what that representation of the past should be like based on the evidence that they have.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's impossible to make a true one-to-one representation of past events. And if you get to that point, it's essentially time travel.
Right. Yeah. Or I think, you know, the divine, right? I mean, arguably, right, that you sort of assume the position of God or a God or some kind of cosmic force that is all knowing and whatever AI promises to be, I don't think it's going to be that.
And then if you go back and you end up changing something, is it even the same past anymore?
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
I asked some followers of Missed History if they had any questions in this regard. Cool. And coming from a social media community of history fans, as you can imagine, a lot of them were interested in video games as well.
Sure.
And Gawoon IK asked, how do you feel games should approach sensitive topics like colonialism and war, especially in cases where those themes are commodified as a fun aspect of the games?
Yeah.
And kind of more to that point, they use Europa Universalis, uh-huh, and slavery, and then Hearts of Iron and the Holocaust,
yeah,
as examples of games that, I haven't played them myself, so correct me if I'm wrong, but they kind of avoid heavier topics so that there's less emotional burden on the player. How do you think that should be balanced? How do you kind of reflect on that?
I mean, it's another essential question. And it's one I think that there are ways in which it is unique to games. Again, because of the nature of the player, but also interlocutor there use the word commodification. And that's another thing about historical games. It doesn't, not inherently, but it, you know, predominantly is that they are made to turn a profit and, you know, to move copies in a way that is definitely not true for an academic monograph. And so that affects also the way that the past is represented and the interlocutor here. Sorry, I forgot their username has suggested.
Gawoon IK.
Gawoon IK.
I don't know if that's how you pronounce it, but we're close.
Well, thanks to Gawoon there. How should they handle it? I mean, it may sound like just oversimplistic, but I mean, I think that comes down to really a kind of a fundamental and a sort of atomic ethical question. And, you know, what is the point of the representation that they are trying to make? How would I, for example, try to, you know, represent the Holocaust or to represent slavery? I don't even want to go down that road exactly. And I'm wrestling with it here because I don't think there's a single answer. I can only think about how games do it poorly or don't do it at all. And that's kind of how most games handle slavery, I think, is to either have it as a completely abstracted, for example, slavery, as a completely abstracted system that is essentially a kind of economic function. And like everything else in the game, especially a game like Europa Universalis, is sort of an actuarial symbol and kind of leaves the question to the player to ignore or to engage with. I haven't played enough of Europa Universalis 4 to remember exactly how they represent slavery. But I mean, you can have like textual things being like, oh, slavery is bad or whatever. Or, you know, coming back to the problem of the player, and like Gawoon says, like, how do you do this in such a way that you aren't forcing the player into uncomfortable choices? I mean, maybe sometimes that's what you want to do. Maybe a sensitive representation of these subjects, as provocative or not, might force the player into making these kinds of moral choices. But then you run into the problem of the bad actor, right? What if someone wants to be an SS officer running the trains to Birkenau? What do you do about that? You know, or someone who wants to be shipping enslaved people across the Atlantic. How do you prevent them from taking pleasure from something which you are trying to convey as immoral? And, you know, I don't know. Some of these things I don't think you can prevent entirely. I mean, especially because games can be modded in various ways, and these things can be put in against the will of the developers anyhow. But I think ultimately, and this has been a very bumbling and very circumlocutionary response, I think ultimately it comes down to, you know, what is it that the game designers want this system or this representation to achieve? And I think they have to think very hard and very carefully about why it needs to be included or why, you know, they're choosing to remove it. Because I think the problem with slavery usually is dealt with by not having it in ways that are end up being historically absurd. Whether it comes through kind of prefatory remarks, whether it comes through some kind of tooltip, or it comes through a disincentive in using that system, or I don't know what. Some, you know, the contextualization that you have for how slavery or how the Holocaust is represented in the game can go a long way to putting down the marker, as it were, of the developers and saying, this is why we have it. This is what we hope for it to achieve. You know, we can't control what the player does, but this is what we intend for this to do. I mean, I'm not sure what more you can do with that other than include it or not include it and change the mechanics of the game appropriately. I'm really sorry. That's a horrible response. It's a very muddled response, but it's a problem that has not been resolved in whether it's in the games themselves or in the literature about the game.
I understand the difficulty in answering. I don't know if there is a clear right or wrong answer. I think what you said is right in the way that it kind of becomes context-based, like game by game. And whoever the game designers are really have to reflect on, is this something that should or shouldn't be in the game if we are representing this period or these time periods? Mm-hmm. Obviously, if it's a more sensitive topic like the Holocaust, simply consulting people with more information on the topic for their perspectives. And then, like, it make it like a, we're timing this episode to come out with the release of the new Civilization game, and I don't recall slavery ever playing a part in those games, despite slavery definitely taking place in the time periods that are depicted. I think in that case it kind of makes sense, but then I also played Call of Duty a lot growing up, mm-hmm. Which takes place during World War II in some of the games. And I vividly remember scenes that maybe I was too young to be playing, maybe not, but scenes towards the end of the game when you're liberating these camps and you see the Nazis prisoners just either dead in heaps or suffering terrible physical condition because of where they were. Mm-hmm. And those scenes aren't included to make the gameplay more fun. It just makes it more real. Mm-hmm. And it's also probably not a one-to-one representation of what things were like, but it left an impression of the hardship that people went through, and not just like, oh, it's fun to run into this building and take out some bad guys. So
you're right, right.
Yeah. I think it's really about finding that balance and taking it case by case.
I don't know about Civ 7 yet about slavery, but I know in like earlier versions like Civ 3, I think maybe Civ 4 as well, like there was slavery as a mechanic where you could sacrifice some of your city populations in order to get a project done early. So basically you could commit mass murder in order to advance some aspect of the game. I think that they have phased it. I don't think it's in Civ 6 or Civ 5 even.
Yeah, I couldn't remember that, but I stand corrected.
But I mean, you know, the fundamental question is, and this is always the fundamental question of any of these historical games, is why are you choosing to represent the past that you are? And I think that, you know, if you can justify the representation with what you're trying to achieve, then, you know, I think anything is possible and anything can be ethical, but it comes down to the question of, you know, how you align what you hope to achieve and how you can justify trying to do that in the game mechanics, whether you're just doing it for fun, as a kind of background or I don't know. I mean, this is, again, it's just gonna, like you say, come down a case by case basis, but I do think it's something that I would like game developers to, I don't know, take more seriously than they have historically.
Mm-hmm. To track back a little bit, mm-hmm. we had been talking about the philosophy of history and historiography. And I noticed that the name Hayden White comes up a few times in your syllabus and kind of your explanation of HRIVG Online. Could you discuss who Hayden White is and what some of his teachings are, why he is relevant to this story?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so Hayden White was a long-lived and highly influential theoretician of history. I mean, also a historian in a certain way, a kind of postmodern theorist, a post-structuralist theorist, emerging out of the kind of post-World War II linguistic turn in cultural theory, and is someone who appears relatively frequently on grad school syllabi for things like historiography or methods courses or something, which is how I first encountered Hayden White. And his most famous book, or at least the one that in my experience like gets put on those syllabi for training historians, is a book called Metahistory, which is from the 1970s. And you know, the kind of short version or the impact of that book is based on his overall argument, which is that, you know, he argues that history writing is inherently a fictive act. It's not fictional in the way that, you know, you just make up something, but it is fictive in that you are essentially all history writing. And he's looking at history writing in a literal sense. He's examining 19th century historians like Michelet and Marx and others. And he's saying that what they are doing, even though they are representing reality, they are at a textual level doing something that is no different from an author, an author of novels, that is, that they are structuring their representation of the past, based on a kind of a plot, an emplotment, a kind of story structure. They rely on linguistic tropes and story beats, if you like, in a more modern sense, the same way that every literary author does, because fundamentally, they are writing. And so they are constrained by, they are guided by the inherent nature of the medium of representation that they're working in. So he's got this whole schema for thinking about the nature of what kinds of plots that they have. And he's got set of like, oh, there are historians who write in this like a tragic mode or heroic mode and all these things. And that's not so much what I've taken away from it as his fundamental proposition that history writing, and indeed all historical representation, is an authorial act, dependent upon authorial choices. And that whether the historian knows it or not, they are operating in language. Hayden White is one of a number of these post-structuralist thinkers who apply that turn in Western philosophy and in cultural thought to history writing. And this has not always been well received among professional historians. You know, there's kind of schools of thought going back to the 19th century where it's like, well, no, we're not making this up in any way. We're simply telling the past as it is, and we're doing so objectively. And what Hayden White and others, but I use Hayden White because I think it's the most accessible in some ways, what they're saying is, okay, you think you're being objective, but you're stuck in language. We're always, all of us, stuck in language. And so whatever language or whatever form of representation that you use, you can't go beyond that. And so you're not giving us the past. You are giving us the way that you have chosen consciously or unconsciously to represent that past. And I keep coming back to the word represent. It's in the title of the course because, you know, I happen to adhere to this idea. And so Hayden White has been a big influence on me ever since I encountered him back in grad school. And I wanted to try to find a way to impart this to my students, you know, not to get them to be, I don't know, acolytes of Hayden White exactly, but to get them to think critically about when they engage with history, they are engaging with representations, and those representations are made by some author who has to make these choices. And so that you can't ever arrive at a truly objective position because you're always bound in the language that you have to use in order to make that representation.
I understand why some historians would be averse to that idea. But on the other hand, I do like the thought that writing history, writing about history, is a creative endeavor to a certain extent. Like, there's a story about Mansa Muhammad Ibn Chu, who is kind of like one of the early leaders of the Songhai Empire in modern-day Mali, and how he supposedly gathered this fleet of ships to sail west from the coast of Africa and see what was on the other side of the body of water. Unfortunately, only one ship returned. He was not on it. The others were lost. But when a historian is writing about something like that, having the choice to represent it as this motivational, heroic endeavor or journey, which can draw in readers, whether they be other historians or people just wanting to learn about the history, it gives them some kind of emotion or something to connect to more.
Yeah,
and maybe try to represent the emotions that were going through those individuals at the time, which of course we'll never know for sure. But it seems better to me than just saying, on this day, this leader put together a fleet of ships and they sailed this direction and most didn't return.
Yeah. No, I mean, look, this kind of bringing in Hayden White is not meant to be a kind of, and I'm not saying that you are, but I mean, your example here is a really good example of showing how being conscious of how we structure these stories and the mode in which we tell them kind of gives us, I don't know, kind of liberates us to use storytelling and to use the fictive act to make our stories, our representation of the past, kind of more creative, to make it more engaging. The point of it all, and the point of my course, is to at least have students make them aware that they are choosing things, right? They aren't just a kind of pass-through, a passive vessel through which the past flows, or that any historian is not simply a passive vessel and is being inhabited by in a oracle-like fashion by the spirit of history and simply telling it the way it was. And I think about, you know, like, this is operating at an atomic level, because it's metaphorically speaking, because it's at the level of language. And I think about this in my own specialized field of modern East Central Europe and thinking about nationalism. One of the more interesting debates that's happened in the last 25, 30 years, as you're probably aware, is around the use of language to describe nationalities and to define groups. And so that, like, you know, when you say the Germans did this, or Germany did that, or Hungary did this, like, you're turning this collection of individuals into a single collective actor in a single historical agent in a way that is not, like, it is metaphorical. Like, there is no single group of, like, not every person who we could plausibly identify or did identify as Hungarian, for example, did one thing, but you're putting them into this collective action that is fundamental to the nature of nationalism, right? So if to speak in terms of countries and nations as actors is to do the work of nationalism. And this is something that I think is just so reflexive that we don't even think about when we do it. But if we bring in ideas like Hayden White's, that we are always and forever fundamentally structuring our representations according to the linguistic habits that we have, if we are made aware of that, then possibly we can challenge ourselves to think about how we represent the past and to do it in ways that are, I don't know, better. And whether that's to make them more engaging, like the story that you've talked about, or to do it in a way that is sometimes intellectually insufferable, like trying to qualify every word that we use for everything. I mean, I think this is actually a kind of liberational project.
With that kind of writing and how you referenced that these ideas or groups kind of form their own unitary singular identity, like Germany did this, Hungary did that, South Africa did this, whatever it may be, you could hypothetically do everything that you can to explain what people within those groups drove those changes on a more micro level, break down every detail. But then most of that will never bleed through to engineering students that are learning a little bit about history in college. Everyone doesn't have time to read that deeply into everything. Mm-mm. So therefore, everything can't be written in that way.
No, it's hard.
Leading to those assumptions.
That's what I thought I was going to do with my dissertation. Then I found that it was it's like a kind of Lovecraftian madness that you could descend into.
With that being the case, I'm curious how your students, especially the non-history majors thus far, have responded to this or the things that you're teaching. And then maybe I could just ask this again after, but what do you think is the right way, or how could people better go about historical communication in the future, kind of comparing it to someone who considers themselves a science communicator, with Neil deGrasse Tyson being this popular figure who just kind of teaches people introductory statements that could be expanded exponentially into a more technical, scientific way. But he tries to put them basically into 15, 30-minute summaries that get people interested and mm-hmm. give people a simple understanding of a more abstract or more complex topic.
Yeah, those are great questions. Let me start with the first one, which is much simpler because it's much more concrete. I think the students really enjoy the course. I mean, it's kind of easy to see why. One of the only courses on campus that they're going to have to play video games as part of their homework. And I think I ask them to play when they have to play. And of course, there is some reading. There's videos that I make in which I analyze games that they don't play. You know, it's like 4 or 5, sometimes 6 hours a week of stuff that they are being asked to do, which is, I think, more than they usually get out of my other courses. But they do it because of the nature of the representation, that they're used to watching videos online. They want this excuse to play these video games and to think about them. And, I asked them at the end of the course as a kind of optional assignment about, do you think about history any differently than when you started this course? And I get many responses in which they say, yeah, or, a specific way in which they think differently about the nature of history and that, or of games or of media literacy. And this is true not only for the few history majors that I do have in the course who might have already had our formal historiography course, but also for the engineers, who most of them have some kind of side interest in history, right? They're watching history YouTube, they're looking at history memes on Reddit, they're playing Paradox games or Assassin's Creed or Call of Duty or whatever. And they come in because they think that they're going to have fun. They stay because they are having fun, but they come out of it through this process being asked to engage with the past and with their understanding of the past in this different way. I think it's been a success. It's a really challenging course to make and to maintain. Historical video games are an insanely inefficient way to represent the past. Just as a kind of side note, like I was thinking about because this game is also coming out soon, Kingdom Come Deliverance 2. One of the games that I feature in my course is Kingdom Come Deliverance. And I didn't even finish that the main storyline of that game, and I played it for 80 hours.
Neither did I.
And I thought, and I have this remark at some point in the course, kind of at the end, where it's, you know, I'm like, how many things could I have read? How many movies even could I have watched about 15th century Bohemia? I could have, you know, it's almost like you could write a master's thesis, not quite maybe, but, you know, approaching that in the 80 hours that it took me to play this game, where what did I even really learn about this period of time? Whatever it is, I mean, the efficiency ratio has got to be just abysmal, right? And it's a different experience than reading all those texts. And the point is not exactly to learn about this past, but I mean, 80 hours, man, I felt like, what am I doing with my life? And some of this stuff is just such pointless tasks, like weeding gardens and like...
You can't forget the fun aspects, though. Not just the history you take from it.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, I just wonder, like, well, what are students left with as far as trying to understand this past era? And, you know, I don't know. I mean, I think it raises some questions about this as a medium and whether it can ever really replace, which I don't think it can, spoiler, but, you know, to the extent that it can replace other forms of historical representation. But the students really enjoy it. I really enjoy that class. I like grading their projects because they're always, you know, creative and unique, and the students are super into it. I've never had discussions as lively on a consistent basis as in that class, because, you know, they actually do the reading, as it were, in a way that they don't always in the other traditional courses. Well, so can you do me the favor of kind of rehashing that second question?
Yeah. For the second question, I made the comparison to Neil deGrasse Tyson considers himself a science communicator. Mm-hmm. I feel like I've heard that term a little bit more and more with different fields of study, whether it's a science communicator, history communicator, or whatever it may be. As someone who has a deep understanding of that field, finding a way to communicate more abstract or more complex concepts into more digestible forms so that the general public or people with like a passing interest in it, someone who may not plan to become an astronomer, but someone who still finds astronomy interesting, a way to get people to understand what may be going on, some of the concepts of that field. So with that idea, I was curious if you thought history communication was changing at all, what you think the better or worse forms of history communication may be, so that when someone is playing as Ezio Auditore in Florence in Assassin's Creed 2, that they might reflect a bit more on the historical time that is being represented and the representation itself.
Yeah, wow, what a question. You know, I think it has changed a lot. I mean, even since I started grad school, say in 2008, 2009, actually 2007. And I think, you know, that was, YouTube had barely kind of existed at that point. But I think YouTube has done, like, really changed the game as far as, I mean, just how anyone consumes media, but especially historical media. I mean, there's just an infinitude of channels about representing the past, whether it's something like Tasting History with Max Miller, or it's the, you know, the various like simplified histories of different things. I mean, I think it's really, it shows that there is a real hunger for engaging with the past and for either learning about it or being entertained by it, or, you know, having some kind of curiosity satisfied. I think that's all to the good, ultimately, especially in an age where history enrollments in a formal college setting are generally declining. It's not because people aren't interested in history. It has to do more with the economics and the structure of how we learn things. Or, you know, not just YouTube, but podcasts also. I mean, there's a proliferation of those things, whether it's a hardcore history or it's like revolutions or, I mean, gosh, there's just seems to be one on every subject. I mean, I'm on one right now, right? So that's all to the good as well. And I think that only amplifies the real desire that people have to not only learn about it, but to speak on it and to educate themselves in the preparation of these programs. So, I mean, that is a big change in the last 15, 20 years for sure, that I think is generally a very positive one. But, you know, as we've broken away from the more, you know, late 20th century model of, you know, getting things through highly produced television documentaries or films or text media, although, you know, books, they still make books. So that's part of it too, is the question of like, how do the inputs get made? Where is the information that these folks are getting? And where does that come from? And, you know, whether that's Wikipedia, which itself has to come from somewhere, or whether that's historical monographs or trade publications or something like that, we always come down back to the fundamental question of where is this knowledge coming from? How is it being made? And I think that part is what is kind of in danger of eroding as support for professional history is crumbling in our academic institutions. And, you know, people who are being paid to produce historical knowledge through original scholarship and through, you know, long, careful, considered study of reading deeply in a field and then trying to talk about it, that is slowly being, or not so slowly, being starved. And so there is a great appetite for popular history, but the question is, where is that information going to be coming from? So to kind of try to bring it back to original question, I think all that history communication is being done, but not necessarily by the professional practitioners themselves. And I think I don't know exactly what needs to happen. I mean, my inclination is to say that yes, professional historians, I think those who are good at communicating in general and those who are willing should be encouraged and given various forms of material benefit, like, you know, time off or leave or something like this, to develop means of popular communication so that they can take their specialized knowledge and their, you know, they've been trained to handle this material in a responsible, disciplined way, to encourage them to make YouTube channels or podcasts or video games. But also I think about the publishing industry and how there's so much historical scholarship out there that people, I think, really like these podcast creators or YouTube creators or video game developers would really benefit from having, but they can't get to it because it's behind an incredible paywall, right? Like Elsevier is charging $150 to like rent some article in, you know, an obscure European history journal. Well, no one's going to read it unless they have they're connected to a research library, which really means you have to be in an academic community. You know, there are these barriers, economic and material, to connecting people who want this knowledge with the knowledge that is already being made. And so I think that is one thing that could really help break down this public and an academic barrier, is the way that knowledge is disseminated. And I think that, you know, YouTube is a very useful way for doing that, but it's not as good as not only encouraging people, but allowing people to be able to do their own research. And I don't use that phrase facetiously. I mean, like to train them to do research that is meaningful and careful and considerate and, you know, professionalized, but it's very hard to do when you actually can't get a hold of this stuff.
I think that's a great summation of it. Sometimes it can be a little bit daunting or depressing at times, to be honest. But
yeah.
I think that it's starting to change. Perhaps that's just me trying to be hopeful, but I think it's starting to change.
I hope so. I mean, I don't want to get too down the discussion about the academic publishing industry, but I mean, you know, like everything, like much in academia, I think it's slowly buckling under the weight of its own contradictions and sort of unsustainability. And, you know, we'll see. I am hopeful that these different, you know, the proliferation of media forms for representing the past or representing anything can have a liberational effect on knowledge.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also been that drive to make at least academic journals more open access.
Yes.
In recent years as well.
Especially in Europe.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me about this. I know your semester started yesterday. I am always happy to talk about video games and history.
Me too.
One final question to leave you with, and if there's anything else you wanted to add, feel free. but you mentioned how you were developing HRIVG as you had your, I think you said, 3-month-old baby.
Yes.
And you're starting to raise your own family. Thinking about what games you may be playing with your kids in the future or exposing them to, is there a game that comes to mind first, or a number one history-based game that you would want them to play?
Oh man, that's a great question. I mean, you know, my kid's already playing video games. He's got some Duplo games on his tablet. He was playing the Bluey game a while ago. You know, and there's some good stuff there. It's not history based, obviously. It kind of depends on, you know, what he's feeling. I think the likelihood of what history game he's going to get into first is some version of Minecraft that is somehow historically connected, but it's too soon to say. It's going to come down to either Assassin's Creed or Civilization's a little bit too much room. It's probably going to come down to Assassin's Creed once I feel like he can handle the violence, or I want to expose him to that violence. The problem is I just haven't played enough games that aren't like that to know what a good one is for a young kid. So yeah, probably Minecraft, actually. Some mod version of that where he gets to run around and...
The Assassin's Creed mod in Minecraft.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure there is one.
Probably. No, that's a really good question. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see what the future holds with that. But
All right.
It's something to think about. Thanks for the provocation there, Luke. Oh, I just want to say that if anyone's interested in this, you can head to hrivg.org where I have, it's not, you know, I could do a better job maintaining it, but I do try to keep the sample videos that I have up there to give you a sense of what this is like. Those are up to date. The course syllabus is up there, and this is all meant to inspire other people, other history professors who might be wondering, like, hey, you know, what do I do? How do I get some video games in my classes? You know what? Maybe you'll get something from it. Maybe it'll give you some ideas, or it's just there for whoever wants to make use of it. I hope you get something out of it.
That's all, folks. I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. Please drop a like and subscribe if you did, so that I can have more guests on like this in the future to discuss all kinds of history-related topics, from photography in the ancient ruins of West Africa to the odd habits of Austria's Habsburg dynasty. More information about the guest and their work can be found in the description. I'm Luke. See you next time.